starting to get into health insurance.
Yeah, or healthcare more broadly. I believe that Amazon will be the largest or the fastest growing healthcare company in the world within 2 to 3 years. Jeff Bezos has famously said, "Your margin is my opportunity." The largest margin, largest dollar business, it's grown prices faster than any sector in the world, is U.S. healthcare. Amazon has a direct pipeline into every home. They have great actuarial data. They know your body mass index. They know how healthy or unhealthy you are. And they have the capital to go into this field. I think Amazon in the next few years is the fastest growing healthcare company in the world.
Scott Galloway, we want to thank you for being with us. We hope to have you back. Professor of Marketing at NYU Stern, author of the New York Times bestseller, The Four and the Algebra of Happiness, host of the Prof G Show and co-host of the Pivot Podcast. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe, save lives, wear a mask.
KBOO Portland.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 8 a.m. on a Wednesday. It's time for Wednesday Talk Radio with your host, Paul Roland. Keep it locked on your community connection.
Hold your head up. Lift the top of your mind. Put your lift your heart to your own home planet. What do you see? What is your attitude? Are you here to improve or damn it? Look right now, and you will see we're only here by the skin of our teeth as it is. So take heart and take care of your link with life.
And good morning, everybody. This is Paul Roland talking at you from my little computer nook in my house here in Southeast Portland. How's everybody doing today? Take heart, hold our heads up. As Buffy says, we're only here by the skin of our teeth. I tell you, it just feels more and more like that every day. As I've occasionally lamented as a talk show host, sometimes it feels rather daunting to assume that I'm in a position to be able to kind of deal myself with what's going on and put it back out in a way that sparks conversation, can be stimulating, hopefully sometimes inspiring, sometimes it can be discouraging. It's always kind of a difficult thing. I don't want to lead to further disempowerment of people by laying on just all sorts of heavy stuff without anything to do about it. But sometimes it feels to me like, I don't know, things are really fast-paced these days, And so much is happening. Hard to take a lot in, hard to keep our heads up and keep moving on, but we must, So, yeah, Representative James Clyburn came right out and said on Sunday's CNN State of the Union that Trump is a Mussolini in the making, and of course instantly got engaged in a Twitter spat. Well, I wouldn't say that Clyburn is probably of the spatting sort. He seems to be more like a tell-it-like-it-is sort. So, and Congress is bickering over the new COVID aid bill while millions of people are facing or going to be facing eviction. I mean, I know we're not getting out and about much, but it's kind of hard not to see all the houseless people living outside in the heat and then in the cold. Can you imagine? Can you imagine multiplying by several factors the number of people having to live out on the street? Well, it's just, as I said, hard to take it all in. So I wanted to talk. I know that Monday, the first Wednesday, kind of like the Monday, first Wednesday of the month has been generally devoted to issues around mental health and mental liberation. And I know recently I've gotten a little bit away from that. And I kind of had wanted to just sort of check in with people, how you're feeling, how you're coping with things, you know, share a few of my stories, my first long bus ride, which I didn't really need to take, and found myself in a bus with a, you know, it's unfortunate. Obviously, there's people who have to take the bus, and some of them are not in the best shape in various ways. And, just may not be that aware of what they're doing. So anyway, a woman was eating, which you're not supposed to do, but, you know, most of us have probably done a little bit of that. But she had a face mask on her wrist. And so I kind of moved away. I don't know. I take care of my elderly mother, so I don't want to bring anything back here. I don't want to get it myself. But then she started coughing. And we're in a public health crisis, and the fact that we exist in this neoliberal capitalist sort of laissez-faire state where there's really very little help for people, very little support networks compared to the real needs, and the public health system is just doesn't really exist in the functional way that it absolutely needs to in a pandemic. And we just can't have this sort of thing happen. I'm not, you know, blaming the bus driver. I'm not blaming TriMet. I'm certainly not blaming the person herself. But we need to take this, you know, and that's just a tiny, 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 tiny sliver. You know, then you got the people who are willfully not dealing with it anyway. So, you know, I realize how we're all much more kind of on the edge. And I was a little bit triggered. I was concerned for, you know, the health of everybody on the bus. And again, it's just a tiny, tiny, you know, situation compared to what is always going on. But it's real for all of us. We're all trying to deal with this stuff. So anyway, that's one thing that came to mind. What are people doing to deal with it? You know, I'm thankfully able-bodied and in good health and able to go on for me are very necessary long walks every afternoon to, you know, be able to get to sleep well and just to be able to just keep feeling upbeat. Everybody's got their things. You know, I do my binging on Netflix. I won't worry about the particular shows. So, you know, how are people feeling? There's also a bunch of other stuff, other substantive things I want to talk about. That blast in Beirut really I just turned on the TV and saw that shockwave. It just scared the heebie-jeebies out of me and brought back, you know, this long litany of technological disasters that a more and more globalized and more unstable and more politically fractured and more whatever kind of world we're living in, there's more and more things are going to just slip through the cracks. Anyway, that's another big issue to talk about. This is a call-in show. 503-231-8187 is the number to call in. I also wanted to acknowledge the passing of Lorenzo Millum, who was I guess you could call him kind of a community radio guru, a promoter and instigator and inspirer of community radio around the country. And he passed away recently. He helped fundamental in starting KABU. Probably he started KABU, I guess. He started a CRAB, KRAB in Seattle, which was, I guess, the first non-Pacifica affiliated community radio station, which unfortunately met its demise a while ago. But KBOO was the next one after that, so I guess we are the oldest, as we say, independent, that is non-Pacifica, a non-Pacifica station. So, Lorenzo Millum, thank you for all that you did. And let's see here. Oh, I also wanted to mention, for those of you who didn't get a chance to hear, Barbara Bernstein's absolutely wonderful Locus Focus show on Monday, which you can find at kboo.fm under, well, just put in the, there's a box on the upper right side, put in Locus Focus. I actually don't have the title, but it was with a longtime Chinook, Lower Chinook Tribal Council member, Sam Robinson, just a wonderful weaving together of history, personal and family stories, culture, the struggles, the setbacks, the persistence of the Chinook people. So that got me thinking about something that I've, especially in this time of reckoning with the being forced or being, have it put in our faces by the Black Lives Matter protesters and others, the necessity to deal with the really terrible and tragic history of this country's founding and how it persists and how it set the basically the foundation that hasn't ever really gone away. Of course, we live here in, well, Chinookan territory for sure, and kind of on the border of the Kalapuyan territory. Of course, they kind of met there at Willamette Falls, right up at Oregon City. I actually had David Lewis of Grand Ronde tribal member and historian who talked about Willamette Falls a number of years ago. So I thought about the you know, we talk about acknowledgments of stolen land, which to me, I always really appreciated as, you know, important reminder, but sometimes they seemed a bit token. I know there's a saying going, a joke, say, I saw somewhere, they stole your land and all you get is a lousy land acknowledgement. Now I know that it really is much more, you know, there really is a lot to them. In fact, there's a lot of substance to them. It really, you know, you hear the names of the peoples who lived here and you get a chance to, a reminder and a chance to, you know, to look it up on your own and think about it more. So anyway, I just felt as my land acknowledgement today, I would read a little bit from David Lewis, one of the many writings about the Native Americans of Oregon, the coastal tribes, the Willamette Valley tribes, and the history. So this is called, and you can find it at Ethno History Research, LLC, also NDN, that's the letters ndnhistoryresearch.com is where I got this. Stingy American settlers of the Willamette Valley. The Kalapuyan tribes of the Willamette Valley have lived here for more than 10,000 years, some 500 generations of people. The whole of the valley was owned by these tribes who had distinct yet overlapping territories. A few sections of the valley were owned by relative newcomers. Whoops. Sorry about that. The Mullalans, who lived in the foothills and parts of the Northeast Valley. The northern part of the valley, where the Willamette River flowed over 35-foot falls, was occupied by the Clackamas tribes, who settled thickly along the upper Willamette, Clackamas, and parts of the Columbia Rivers. These tribes lived in harmony with one another, marrying together under tribal laws that made intermarriage essential parts of the culture. Intermarriage helped all tribes become closer relatives, lessen conflicts across the region. Tribes were less likely to attack, raid, or even steal from a relative. Common tribal codes of behavior made it necessary for the tribes to treat outsiders and visitors with respect, to host them, feed them, offer them a place to stay when journeying through a tribe's homelands. The visitors, too, were expected to approach the villages with honorable intentions, to first meet with the local chiefs and headmen, share stories and gifts to let everyone know that they came in peace and honored the tribes that own that place. For tribal people wishing to fish at Willamette Falls, they would first have to request to land their canoes at the Kluwala village, sit in conference with the chief, share what they had, and later be granted the honor of fishing the falls. Most times the visitors would not rudely ask. They would wait patiently to be granted access to the falls, an honor granted freely by the chief at the right time. Much of these exchanges happened through Chinook Wawa or Indian Sign Language, as many tribes in the region did not have common languages. Tribes had varying degrees of formal behavior depending on the class, title, family relations, and wealth of the visitors. Permission for fishing was always granted for appropriate behavior. Chiefs would act swiftly to bar and drive from the area those who acted selfishly and without honor. The white men, Bostons, I really like that repeated, Sam Robinson's repeated use of that old term, Bostons. So obviously, I guess the first people came from the Northeast, from the Massachusetts area. And the white men, Bostons and King George's men, were different. A few of these people acted appropriately, but most did not. The first white men many tribes on the Columbia saw were the men of the Lewis and Clark expedition. The expedition leaders approached the tribes with gifts and would sit and meet them appropriately as diplomats during most encounters. The expedition gave out peace medallions and in return requested information about the route westward. They asked for a map, for the names and numbers of the tribes and rivers, and for information like population counts and wealthy resources to be had. The chiefs would draw maps on animal hides. I'm sorry, I laughed because probably wasn't the greatest idea in hindsight, but in the sand and or on tree bark. Some of these maps were copied by Clark into their extensive journals. The gifts were welcomed by the tribes, but the most important part of the exchange was the mutual sharing of information. Tribes like the Nez Perce, Nimipu, were so interested in the Bible after 2 weeks of hearing about Christianity and the Bible from the expedition. Well, actually, this kind of deviates a little bit from what I want to write about, but it's interesting. You can go back and check on it yourself. After the explorers came the traders and then the settlers. Some of the first settlers were the fur traders from Hudson's Bay Company. These men were, many of them, French Indians, meaning they were half Indian in their heritage. Well, it goes on and on. Anyway, I want to get to when the settlers first came, they were tolerated, hosted, and fed by the tribes. Many of the earliest settlers had to be taught where the food was, and native people fed them with dried salmon, venison, camas cakes, and fruits and berries. Kind of reminiscent of the Thanksgiving story. The tribes had a neighborly sharing attitude towards the newcomers, like they had with other tribal peoples that visited. Those in need were fed and housed without question. Some settlers appreciated their receptions. Others were standoffish and effusive. And years later, when the tribes were in need, many settlers would not share in kind. These same settlers had taken over a mile of land and plowed under the native prairies and planted their own food crops. They environmentally changed the land, eliminated native food resources, and then fenced off their fields. They assumed that they would take their lands from the tribes, and then selfishly and stingily bar entry by natives. As years went by, more and more of the prairies went away under the plows. The game was hunted out, and fish wheels were established, quickly depleting fish and animal species, which was staple foods of the tribes. And it goes on, and you can imagine where it goes from here, and he doesn't here get into the whole legal, well, actually later he does, gets into the tribal claims to the lands were somewhat protected under various American laws and policy statements. And it gets very complex, and basically the upshot is that they basically made an agreement between Great Britain and the United States, forget what the treaty was called, the Oregon Treaty, before actually dealing with the tribes, which they should have dealt with first because it was their land after all. But of course, in the empire's way of thinking, they didn't really quite exist at the same level. So it goes on, and then we get to 1851 and all the treaties signed, you know, negotiated and signed with all the different bands and tribes in the Willamette Valley, and then never ratified. And then there's 1856 treaty, I believe, which was unratified by the Clackamas and others, and on to the present. There's something I'm in discussions about, like delving further into. Hopefully something will come of that, and so we'll be talking more about that. I just wanted to sort of use that, as I say, as my land acknowledgement, especially since, as I just realized as I was saying that, I've been spending time out at the confluence of the Clackamas and Willamette Rivers. A very popular spot, a very wonderful spot. Yesterday, I actually tried to do lap swimming in the river because it kind of the current slows down there as it bunches up against the Willamette. It was different, and if anybody out there is jonesing for a place to try to swim, that's a place you might give it a shot. Don't imagine we'll get too many throngs out there trying it, but it's an interesting experience. So anyway, that's where that area is, partly where I was just talking about. Okay, so 503-231-8187. What would you like to talk about? What would you like me to talk about? You have any suggestions for people or subjects to bring on the airwaves? I'd like to make this as interactive as possible. Those are the things I want to introduce. I've got some other articles up on the page here talking about climate change, the heating up of the Arctic, the possibility that we're going to be seeing ice-free Arctic North Pole coming up in August. May not happen. The temperatures can shift. But that's the kind of stuff we should be dealing with right now instead of floundering around not dealing with this massive health crisis, which is COVID-19, which, as I said earlier, I'm sure everybody has their own experiences in dealing with the fallout from it, which is just massive. I am extremely fortunate myself that I'm rather buffered, and I know that there's a lot of people who aren't, probably some people who are listening who may even resent me saying that I'm buffered. I hope we don't start fighting amongst ourselves as things, you know, are things really going to get ugly? Are all these people going to be evicted? Is there going to be, you know, is our partisan politics on the Republican side mainly? I think, you know, it's true that the Democrats did come up with their own bill 3 months ago, which, you know, had much, much more relief for municipalities and states and for frontline workers, for working people in general, eviction relief, unemployment relief. But, of course, that won't go over. The Republicans are so in hostage to Trump, for one thing, in hostage to the neoliberal ideology, capitalist ideology, that they can't see any other possibility. How can we break free in our, you know, local areas and join up together nationally? Those are my thoughts. I guess I should go to my KBOO page to see if we have... Oh, we had Tim, but Tim has left. It's because I wasn't looking at my KBOO Wednesday Talk Radio Facebook page, which you too can go to and post me a comment or question there. But you can also call up at 503-231-8187. That's the number to get connected. Tim, please call back. The Beirut explosion. I mean, I just I think of those tanks there on the along the Willamette River and the possibility of an earthquake or the possibility of something else happening. I think of, you name it, the massive deregulation that's going on at the same time as the Republicans are, and many Democrats are, so enthralled to the idea, the myth, that somehow the market can deal with whatever comes its way. Magical thinking. What kind of magical thinking do you engage in? What kind of magical thinking do you need to come to grips with? Yeah, 503-231-8187 is the number to call and talk to me. Let's go to this article I looked up. Neuroscientist explains why Christian evangelicals are wired to believe Donald Trump's lies. I thought this was very fascinating. That talks about that it's much easier to believe than not to believe. I think that's a very profound thing, that the cognitive energy that it takes to doubt something is a lot more. They actually did some research where they actually asked people a bunch of questions, and they said some very straightforward questions. Like, for example, whether they believed that California is larger than Rhode Island, while others were more abstract and subjective. God actually does not exist. The results showed the activation of distinct but often overlapping brain areas in the belief and disbelief conditions. While these imaging results are complicated to interpret, the electrical patterns also showed something that was fairly straightforward. Overall, there was greater brain activation that persisted for longer during states of disbelief. Greater brain activation requires more cognitive resources, of which there is a limited supply. What these findings show is that the mental process of believing is simply less work for the brain, and therefore often favored. The default state of the human brain is to accept what we are told because doubt takes effort. Belief, on the other hand, comes easier. This troubling finding makes sense from an evolutionary standpoint. If children question every single fact they are being taught, learning would occur at a rate so slow that it would be a hindrance. Of course, actually, if you look at face-to-face kinship societies, village, tribal societies, children mostly learn by watching, by being immersed in the day-to-day cultural activities, work, play, preparing food, other cultural, ceremonial, and they learn by actually edging their way into participation through observation and eventual participation. So belief in those societies tends to be a much more, I'd say in a way, bodily thing, kind of like we learn musical instruments, we have to learn it bodily, it's a bodily memory. In our sort of schizoid civilized Western culture, we've sort of gotten more into the sort of separated mental realm, which then acts upon, you know, the material realm as if it's separate through, you know, plans for building structures and all sorts of stuff. It's a long, long, long process of the development of engineering and mathematics and, you know, all these things which basically sort of help create, as in the Descartes, I think, therefore I am. Anyway, that's just a little excursion from this writing, which the troubling finding makes sense from an evolutionary standpoint. If children question every single fact they're being taught, learning would occur at a rate so slow that it would be a hindrance. But this fact could be just as easily applied to both the political left and right. So how does it explain why conservatives, specifically evangelicals, are so easily duped by Donald Trump? For Christian fundamentalists, being taught to suppress critical thinking begins at a very early age. It is a combination of the brain's vulnerability to believing unsupported facts and aggressive indoctrination that create the perfect storm for gullibility. Of course, this, as we know, goes way beyond just Christian fundamentalists. So I ask, what's your framework that suppresses critical thinking? Due to the brain's neuroplasticity, or ability to be sculpted by lived experiences, evangelicals literally become hardwired to believe far-fetched statements. The wiring begins when they are first taught to accept biblical stories not as metaphors for living life practically and purposely, but as objective truth. Mystical explanations for natural events from train young minds to not demand evidence for beliefs. As a result, the neural pathways that promote healthy skepticism and rational thought are not properly developed. This inevitably leads to a greater susceptibility to lying and gaslighting by manipulative politicians and greater suggestibility in general. If we want to combat the brain's habit of taking the path of least resistance, which has destructive downstream consequences for critical thinking, as a society we must place more value on empirical evidence and this must be reflected in how we educate our youth. It goes on in very noble sentiments, but I just thought that first piece was very fascinating. So let's go. We have a caller on the line. Looks like it's Camilo. Go ahead, Camilo. Welcome.
Hi. I'm going to respond to what you said about the land acknowledgement being a kind of superficial lip service.
Well, sometimes it strikes me that way, but often
yeah.
I don't feel and that way. But yeah,
I relate to that because I'm in a group, Buddhist climate group, and we do a land acknowledgement, and I read it each month, and it tends to be a little bit rote. But I want to mention the organization BARC. BARC is the volunteer organization that's now 20 years old that defends environmental and recreational and the Mount Hood Forest, which is always under threat.
And all the critters that reside within.
Exactly. And what I just want to say is that BARC has implemented a policy of doing a very real, profound land acknowledgement that is really sincere and serious. And they also have a policy of trying to incorporate indigenous and people of color into their leadership. And lately we've been having classes on how to make comments to the National Forest Service about the timber sale that's coming up, the zigzag timber sale. And at the start of each one of those classes, there's the land acknowledgement, and there is a moment of silence, and also an invitation for people to write how they think they're going to incorporate the matter of this acknowledgement into their own thinking. So I just wanted to point out that BARC is really doing a very serious move with this. And also
right.
Anybody who's interested in supporting BARC to go to the website, it's bark-out.org, and get involved in the comment writing to the Forest Service about the zigzag sale. And that those comments have to be in by August 10th.
Yeah, I actually just got a email from Michael, the BARC Forest Watch coordinator. So I'll actually read that after you get off the air, because that's an area that was very important in the 90s with the Enola Hill timber sale, which many, many thousands of people in more or less direct ways got involved in, and was a kind of a major moment in the forest defense movement history, at least here in the Willamette and Chiwana, otherwise known as the Columbia River Confluence area. And many people got arrested, and it was, in fact, there have been no timber sales proposed since
that
happened.
Yeah, it's been 20 years.
Yeah.
Since the last one.
Yep. So, yeah, I'll read that. I thank you for bringing that up. And, yes, I didn't mean in any way to be flippant or to presume or to say.
No, I didn't think you were.
Yeah.
But
I don't want it to seem like any particular land acknowledgement that I've heard is like somehow faulty or done insincerely or that it's not appropriate. I just felt that sort of just because, you know, because the issues are just so the fallout, as I was starting to talk about, from the, you know, the fact that the reason why this land isn't still their people is because there are actually these treaties that the, you know, that the people signed in good faith, negotiated and signed in good faith, expecting that something would come of it, basically just got shelved, you know, and there's a whole history of that in the Senate and never ratified because the directive had come down that the Willamette Valley was to be vacated of indigenous people. That was the goal, was to move them all to the east side. That was really the voice from Washington, which didn't actually have to meet the people, but But anyway, it's a really, really long history. But there's a real history there that a lot of people, I think, don't know about. And there's ways that we could actually, you know, bring that. You know, there's truth and reconciliation commissions. There's been, you know, there's actually, you know, the I think it's called the Native Arts Council was just gifted the arts building in inner southeast Portland as a, you know, kind of a return. So there's things that can be done. There's organizing that can be done that we certainly haven't done enough of. So I think this is a good moment to bring that up and to again take that land acknowledgement to the next levels.
Yeah, and to take it seriously and to be respectful.
Right on, and it's good that some people are taking it to where BARC is, to an actual a real integral part of the organization and how it works.
Yeah.
And stuff. That's really crucial. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Camilo.
Bye bye.
And so let me just read this, since Camilo brought it up, and since I went to BARC, I shouldn't admit these things on the air, and got documents relating to this particular timber sale and haven't done anything with them. So here, Dear Paul, the Mount Hood Forest Service is again under pressure to meet rising timber volume quotas by logging forests in the headwaters of the Sandy and Salmon River watersheds, and I believe this has to do with a Trump executive order. Approximately 2,000 acres would be logged to meet the goals of the, quote, zigzag and integrated resource project. That's Zigzag Ranger District, just up 26 from here. You know, Zigzag, Rhododendron, that area. The Forest Service is accepting public comment on the project's draft environmental assessment until August 10th. That's next Monday, and today's Wednesday, so do the math. This particular area of forest has inspired me ever since I first visited. This is Michael Crocto's writing this. Early on, when I started working with BARC, while ground truthing with volunteers in 2012, I explored a unit of the Horseshoe Timber Sale. It was unlike forests I had seen proposed for logging elsewhere. It was dynamic and diverse. There were big trees and small, alive and dead, standing and fallen. Water percolated the ground. The prehistoric-looking skunk cabbage and tall devil's club plants surrounded me. To get there, I drove along the upper Sandy River and followed signs for Ramona Falls and the Top Spur Trail. I was taken aback that this mosaic of forest was targeted for a logging proposal under the Obama administration's increase in Forest Service timber targets. Thankfully, that project was canceled in 2013. Unfortunately, history repeats itself. In recent years, the Forest Service invested millions of public dollars restoring the Sandy and Salmon River watersheds to protect vulnerable fish, including steelhead trout, Chinook, and coho salmon. Now, the acres of a, quote, mechanical harvest on steep slopes above the same streams in areas at high risk for flooding and erosion. The impacts of removing the forest canopy above sensitive watersheds are intensified by the changing climate. Snowpack and glaciers that keep summer water temperatures cool enough for salmon will soon become unreliable. The intact, never-been-logged forests surrounding these rivers and their tributaries are ever more important to shade the waters and keep them cool. Unfortunately, the climate change analysis included in the Zigzag environmental assessment is copy and pasted from past agency planning documents, lacking any specific analysis of the climate impacts of this proposal. Earlier this year, BARC encouraged the agency to protect large trees, which are habitat for rare species like red tree voles. We were grateful to find out that the Forest Service had recently located nests of red tree voles in the Zigzag project and dropped the timber units they were in from the proposal, protecting the species. Thanks to volunteers and commenters, we have been able to change the project for the better. But there's still work to do. There are important features and habitat that need to be buffered from the impacts of logging. And the Forest Service needs to hear from you. What management priorities do you want to see as opposed to timber quotas in the Zigzag area managed? So if you got this email, you'd click on this thing to actually go to to be able to directly comment. But you can do that by going to the BARC website, as Camilo very kindly pointed out. I could have had him on the air today, but I didn't. So it's BARC-out.org, BARC-out.org. That's the website for BARC, if you have a computer. If you don't, you can probably find their number and call up. So 503-231-8187. I'm looking for callers. I'd like to talk to you, whoever you are. I could talk more about neuroscience. I could tell you more about the history of Enola Hill. I could talk about how I've been doing and, you know, bucking up. But like I said, I'm not facing a lot of the really, really difficult challenges that a lot of people are. And that is, my buffers allow me to deal with whatever psychic shocks and, you know, emotional ups and downs that I have. And that's the way we all should be, really. But there's some people who are, you know, have their insulation frayed and are, you know, closer to, you know, hitting a live wire or getting their live wire exposed or whatever metaphor you want to use. And it's just getting really, really, really difficult, especially with the eviction scenario, which really, it's really mind-boggling to contemplate. And at the same time, all the other things are going on, like timber sale planning. Of course, as we know, the Trump administration has been sneaking through an unprecedented amount of executive orders, policy directives to eliminate the flimsy regulatory structure that we have, and putting into people in the office to gut a lot of the agencies that are tasked to protect us from things like a warehouse apparently full of 2,000 tons or whatever of ammonium nitrate fertilizer, which was used to blow up the Oklahoma federal building, and who knows what exactly caused it, but leaving them there in a, you know, it's hot in the Middle East in probably a hot warehouse for 6 years is a recipe for disaster, just as, you know, the under-checked nuclear plants and whatever other factories, especially now with the Trump deregulation, they're just disasters waiting to happen. But I could keep going on and on about this and more, but I'd really like to talk to you. 503-231-8187. We only have 20 minutes left. Don't wait till the very end. How are you feeling about the perhaps sending the feds packing? It's unclear. Are they still here? Are they holed up in the Bonneville Power Administration building, as I heard someone say? They certainly are, at least aren't out on the streets causing mayhem. So I like to give credit where credit's due. I mean, I'm not a big fan of Mayor Ted Wheeler, but you know, he did make the right moves, I think. Certainly Kate Brown, our governor, spoke out. I think the best case scenario for what we're dealing with at all levels is continuing to put pressure on our local state officials, thanking them when they do good work, but staying in the street, staying, you know, lobbying, whatever kind of pressure you put on, and try to, you know, develop working relationships, but let them know that they, you know, develop our own political clout, which we seem to be developing, at least in Portland, in terms of electing more progressive city commissioners, and holding their feet to the fire, making them do the right thing, voting them out when they don't, and, you know, because they do afford a level of buffering and protection and insulation, I think, when they do what needs to be done, when they stand up against the Trump administration, band together with others. But I don't, you know, see that as the political structure as the ultimate protection layer. We need to radically change the way that our political economy works. Well, it looks like we got someone else waiting patiently on the line. Let's hear from Karen. Good morning.
Good morning, Paul. My question is, What is the difference in terms of cognitive demand, energy demand, between denial and real critical thinking? And I'm sorry, I missed the earlier part of your program, so I just got in on...
What do you think, I'm a neuroscientist?
Well, you sounded very well informed.
Oh, that's because I was reading an article by probably a scientific journalist who had done their homework and was able to basically quote the study. And actually, that's a good question. I'll go back there. I don't know if they actually speculate. My tendency is to say it's almost sort of common sense that if someone tells you something, as if they had, like, they know it or they've seen it, especially, an older person, a child, because I think a child is sort of naturally, there's a certain natural trust that develops by the fact that they're being fed and taken care of by the parent. So I think it's sort of an extension of that. Wouldn't you think that the parent tells them something that they would want to believe it? And so I think that sort of gets, we're all in some ways children in relationship to the vast technological apparatus and the ability of public relations to spin. So just think of like having to like go through a series of links to get to the original source of something, to find out actually who said what to begin with. That takes way more work than just accepting it at face value.
Yeah, that is my intuition too, that it takes, if you go into simple denial, that's just a blanket negative. And I'm thinking, I'm trying to figure out the right wing, right? So they just deny anything that the left says, and basically we also deny anything Trump says, but we base it on evidence, and we have to use a lot of critical thinking, investigation, as you just mentioned, and then synthesizing and so on, and analyzing. And so that does take a lot more energy. So I said, thanks for helping me think this through. I just was curious because it seemed to me that, sadly, the right wing spends very little time thinking about things in a detailed, analytical, and logical way. And that's really, really sad. But thank you.
Well, sure. Thanks for calling in. And you too, whoever you are, have only about 10 minutes left to call up 503-231-8187. I would not want to exonerate the left or whatever. As I kept saying throughout, is like, what is your area that you're in denial about? It's kind of hard to go in. Now, that may be the hardest thing, to have been thinking certain things for a long time and to think differently about them. And so I don't think anyone is exempt from the need to do that. I mean, I could go on and litany of my criticisms of the quote left, from labor movement racism in the early part of the century up to even now to patriarchy at all levels, to look at all the so-called liberals in Hollywood and other ways who are just horrible the way they treated women. But you probably, David, have something equally compelling to say as me. Let's hear what you got.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I am, a little bit changing the subject a bit, because you had mentioned that a lot of people are, going to be suffering from this lifting of the rent freeze. And, I've been hearing on the news about how the Republicans are offering this short-term deal to Democrats, saying we'll keep the rent freeze in until we have a little bit more time to negotiate. And while I realize that this is kind of a, political blackmailing way to go about it, in a very practical sense, that's going to affect, millions of people's lives in a positive way. And so I'm really struggling with, I'm kind of battling back and forth in my own mind about how I sit with this issue. And I'd love to hear from you on how you feel about whether or not the Democrats should, take this deal, and really look at it as a practical situation for,
Well, you seem to know more about it than I do. I haven't looked into the nitty gritty of it, so I don't know what the bitter pills of which there will be huge ones that that they would have to swallow to accept that. So yeah, I haven't gone into deep enough to be able to make any kind of assessment weighing the different factors. Yeah, I mean the tendency is, I mean I think the Democrats generally have tended to. I mean the fact that they got that much seems to be an indication it was a good thing that they didn't give in right away. So that in itself tells you, you know, it's an incredibly difficult time. I mean everybody's under pressure to make something happen, you know, and even accept these huge bailouts of billionaires, which is obscene, just to get this minimum of support, financial support for struggling people. It seems, yeah, I would hate to be in that situation. So what do you think about it?
Well, I mean, as a principle, I would say, you know, if I was going to take a principled stand, I'd say let's not give in, because it really it's just, you know, offering, you know, this rent freeze, you know, a continuation of the rent freeze to just push the problem down the road. So principally, I'd say, no, don't take the deal. But when I look at it from a really practical standpoint, because I'm not a renter, but if I was a renter, I'd be wanting Democrats to take that deal just so I could, you know, stay in my place a little bit longer.
Let me just ask you. I admit I should be way more up to this. So are you talking at the federal level or the state level?
No, the federal level, President okay. Trump and Republicans, McConnell.
You mean a rent freeze or the unemployment, $600 unemployment?
Yes, both. So those are the two things that were offered, an extension okay. of both those things.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, I forget how long it was, maybe a month, 2 months, maybe it was just one or two checks of the unemployment to give them a couple of weeks to hammer out a deal. So it wasn't this, you know, people's benefits weren't going to be running out. People weren't going to be kicked out of
their
places.
Oh, I see. But you're saying to just sort of pass a more limited measure, allowing that to happen while they go on negotiating on the bigger package. Is that what you're saying?
Right. Just a very tender.
Well, I don't see, if that's all it is, I don't see what the Democrats would have to lose on that. I mean, or anybody would have to lose, because that's what is needed right now is just an infusion, so people don't lose their places to live and end up houseless.
Yeah, I agreed. I feel like in this situation, the practical needs to take over. But there's such a dynamic in politics of not wanting to lose, you know. So the Democrats, were they to accept, you know, this very temporary, suggestion by the Republicans, by President Trump, I feel like it would be seen as a loss or an acquiescence of some point.
That
idea of losing kind of, you know, seems to trump, in any benefits that could be paid for real people right now, you know, in tough situations.
Yeah. Well, that's, as I said, you know more about it than I, but it sounds like a conundrum. But I'll have to read up more on that. But thank you for calling in with that.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. We got about 7 minutes left. 503-231-8187. We maybe our last caller is Robbie. Go ahead. You're doing it once again. You're ending the show.
I'm sorry. I don't mean to. It's just the way it works out, I think. I had two things, and I was going to let you choose what you wanted to talk about. I was either going to talk about the protests here, or I was going to talk about COVID. What do you think I should
You talk about whatever you want to talk about.
Oh, geez, I can't make up my mind, because, okay, you want to go down a conspiracy rabbit hole with me, or do you want to talk about the Portland
Probably
protests?
Not, but let's give it a 30 seconds at least.
Okay, 30 seconds. You ready for this? Do you know why I think COVID-19 was man-made?
Why is that?
So there was tons of research papers in the American Microbiology Institute and the Journal of Virology that was showing that Wuhan laboratory that everybody's talking about, they were working with coronaviruses from the horseshoe bats, and they were interlacing it with HIV to jump to the ACE2 receptor in humans. This is a 2007 paper that it's American Microbiology Research of Institute, the Journal of Virology. It's published significant amounts of research paper into the how that laboratory was attempting to create immunities and vaccines to these coronaviruses. So, as you may know, the SARS outbreak happened in the same laboratory. But here's where it gets really interesting. Hello? They were working with coronaviruses from the horseshoe bat. Hello?
Oh, dear. Sorry, everybody. Something seems to have gone weird in the little box I used to route your calls through the mixing board. I don't know if we have Paul. We may need to call it. Stand by. Keep it locked. And we are back. Thank you, folks, for hanging out. Paul?
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Sonia. Sorry about that, Robbie. Sorry about that, listeners. My landline was running out of juice, and it was beeping, and it was going to die, so I tried to get the other phone, which didn't seem to work out. So sorry about that five-minute confusion. So I missed you. You're probably continuing to talk through all that, but I missed it. So, yeah, I don't know. That's a really I wanted to talk about that, but it deserves an hour show, and I can't respond. The only thing I've heard, you know, is there was a study came out where scientists had said that they studied the DNA of the coronavirus that causes COVID-19, and because of certain characteristics, they decided that it couldn't have derived from a genetically engineered. I always wanted to, you know if there was a debate about that, if there were other scientists who differed. You know, some people are legitimately asking that question. I think other people are opportunistically using that to muddy the waters. So I think it's kind of a precarious subject to go into without solid, as we were talking about earlier, empirical evidence.
I would love to provide the Nobel Prize scientist who worked on an HIV, who's worked on HIV his time, and his name is Professor Luc Montagner, Luctagnir.
Let me ask you to do me a favor, is to go to the KBOO website and go to KBOO Wednesday Talk Radio and go through the steps, and you can email any producer, any program host through the KBOO website, which is always a good thing to know. I'm always interested to hear what people have to say, and sometimes I end up striking up correspondences. But if you could do that and provide me the link there, or at my KBOO Wednesday Talk Radio Facebook page, and It looks like James called, but yeah, you're not going to be able to get on. That was my fault about the little slip up there at the end. But yeah, I think it deserves a full conversation, Robbie. I certainly don't dismiss it out of hand. It's like one of those things you would think that if it had some traction, really, that it would be getting more. But you know, that's not always true. There are a lot of things that get swept under the rug. There's a lot of anyway. So yeah, thanks for bringing that up. But
yeah, I'll email you. I'll email you that. Maybe we could talk about it some other day. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Robbie. Always good to hear from you, and always good to hear from our other listeners. Bit of a scattershot show today, but that's the way it goes sometimes. Probably be back with my second Wednesday co-host, Jacqueline Keeler, next week, if she and the fates are willing. So with that, I think we're just about out of time. Thank you, everybody. This is Paul Rowlands. Support your community radio station. Go to kboo.fm. Click on donate if you can and haven't. All right. Thanks. Bye.
Concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available.